Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
I like the hot ignite.
The hot ignite?
Mm-hmm. The hot ignite is good. It's like apple cider.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wait.
And cocoa? No,
I'm about the sleepy ones are good, too. I like those.
Those are good. Yeah, those are really good, too.
The sleepy chop, sleepy cider, and the sleepy cocoa.
Yeah, we ran those in the backcountry fuel boxes, and that was like probably the last box I was there for, maybe the second to last one. So I had a whole bunch of those last season, and I think I need to order some more for this season, especially that late hunts and stuff when it's dark at 6.
Yeah, so that hot really makes a big difference. It's kind of your get your mind right again. Buddy Harrison was up on some caribou hunts and moose hunts and all that stuff up north out of Fairbanks, and he says just that hot meal kind of gets you back squared away.
Yeah,
glassing for dall sheep, or it's in the fog or something like that. You have something. He says peanut butter makes him angry, but a hot meal is what he's looking for, or a hot drink.
That's funny. Yeah, man, I'm excited for these late season hunts. Actually, I mean, I know that like these early season ones, like I mean, our season kicks off tomorrow, but October and November are when my two big trips are. So,
I get excited for it too, but it just always seems like it goes so fast. And then when you're looking at just the downhill, it's going to be wet and it's going to be cold and it's going to be dark. And it just seems like it compiles. The years just start to stack up. The first year you're back in Alaska, or the second year, it's not a big deal. But then after a while, it's like, oh, here we go again. But then you start thinking, man, I got deer until November. I've got, ducks and geese and sea ducks starting in a couple weeks going to, so I got so much stuff to do, but you kind of want to hold on to these last days of warmth.
Yeah, dude, it was 37 degrees. Oh, I should not start this too soon, but it was 37 degrees in my antelope blind on Sunday.
Oh,
it was chilly.
But you were pretty bundled up though, and that's good. And that's having that right gear for that. So if you do get a curveball, it's so nice to have that. And I've built, now I'm at the point now where I've built enough clothes that I feel good for anything, and it's pretty awesome. And
yeah, when you're prepared, it makes all the difference.
Yeah.
I remember as kids, we would sit in the goose blinds and or the duck blinds, and it'd be January or February, and us boys would be shivering our butts off. And it's funny, like my brothers, my stepbrother at the time and my little brother, they didn't like it at all. And for some reason, I ran hotter than them, or I just didn't care that my fingers were freezing off, because I liked it. And, you know, those bad experiences, my little brother finally came back around, but it took him a while, you know, to get the good gear and to get the motivation to go back out and get cold.
Yeah. I think the last piece were these Grundon's bibs that I got. It's the full on rubber. So it is fishing gear. I look like I'm going fishing in an open skiff in the rain, but it's just it's just so cold and so wet. And so you trap all that stuff in. It doesn't matter. I've had a pair of Sitka Gore-Tex pants. Like you just get wet. You just get wet. So that thing, at least it's going to be a warm wet, and you have the Grundon's boots and you're in good shape. So yeah, I'm pretty happy now. I'm sure I'll be able to figure out something else to buy, but that's always going to happen.
Yeah, for sure. And until I start going to the Pacific Northwest or Alaska a bunch more, you know, it's nice to be in that position where you're just like, all right, I really don't need anything. If I need something, it's because I quote unquote need it, and I just want a different color. Like I can make do with what I've got, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, that was a long period of time to go without the intro, but I wanted to get rolling because sometimes we have some good stuff that starts right off the bat. So this is Jaden Bales's, I don't know, got to be close to 10th time on the show here.
Yeah, your Wyoming correspondent, as you've, you know, so named me, and I appreciate it. I like talking with you, man. And this is one, how we can kind of touch base. And then two, maybe this is your lower 48 reporting. So yeah. I take it as upon my role.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I'm finding so many more similarities, like some basic hunting consistencies or some universal type things. And one of the things I want to talk to you about was your antelope hunt and just that waiting. And then you sent the text of, there was a broken arrow because you sat for 14 hours or something like that, and you airmailed the shot or something. And
oh yeah, I want to pull it up. Some of our, I like reading your text, your night text, because they're pretty witty. I'm gonna say, it must be that writer in you. We should touch on some of that stuff, but man, it was just, yeah, I spent a lot of time spotting stalking after work. I spent a lot of time, 32 total hours in the blind, including a miss. And it was just, it was a grind. I don't know of any archery hunting. There's one story of archery hunting that wasn't a grind, and it was the first day of archery hunting of all time for me. I walked out and shot a buck, and then I haven't shot a mule deer buck with my bow since. And that was near and on 9 years ago. So
I don't know if it's good to have that success right off the bat. If your first deer is like this really nice 4-point, you know, like up here, we're talking blacktail. Like if you get a 4x4, like that's kind of what everybody aims for. Down there, you can have, you know, mule deer that's a 4-point, like I shot, that's tiny. But there's just so many different varieties. And if your starting spot is really, really good, or you have success right off the bat, I'm not sure if that's necessarily a positive thing. If you're going to be able to do the hunt again, because then you're, you know, it's such a step down from that epic experience.
Well, man, and I think so much of it is like, as long as you're enjoying the whole process, I think that's crucial, right? So if I walked out, because this is what happened, I walked out there, shot this, you know, nice, he's a wide 3-point buck in full velvet. And then after that, you know, it was all a struggle, right? But I had such a high from that first day that it's just been like, I'm probably an addict at some level where you're just like chasing that high. And when I got, you know, when I just shot, anytime I've shot something with my bow since then, it's just like that a moment of elation where, you know, like, oh, that shot was perfect and they're going to go down. Like that is what you're chasing a little bit, you know? But like, there's an element of it too, where, and maybe this is the sadistic part of you and me and a bunch of other folks who love to go out and do this stuff, like, in terrible weather or like for long periods of time. It's like any minute, you know, it can turn around and all of a sudden it's just like this, like I said, elation. So, it keeps you in it. It keeps you in the game, man. I love it.
Yeah. It was funny when you said that you didn't, like the right thing to say, I think, or the thing that we say a lot of times is, oh man, it's okay. Good try. You'll get the next one. But really, it's not okay.
When I missed that
out there. Yeah. You went out there to get something and you didn't. As a basketball coach, I would say that a lot, because it's not okay when you do those things. Like it's going to happen, right? I mean, we're not expecting perfection here, but we need to focus on the fact that we can't just glaze over certain things. And if you just glaze over certain things, and you don't get better. So there was a different focal point, or you said you had it, you had a rock that was ranged at 37, but it was actually 44 or something like that.
Yeah,
I think sometimes the worse you feel bad, the less likely you might do that thing again.
Yeah, oh, totally. And you know, I think it's having it's like a healthy balance. And I think I texted you at some point, it was about a different topic, but the healthy balance in this scenario is more like a seesaw. You have to acknowledge that sometimes when you miss, you're going to be super down because you did something super stupid or whatever. And then sometimes when you miss and you know it went wrong, you can shrug it off and be like, I know exactly what I did wrong and I can prevent that next time. So yeah, I think just depending on where you're at and which mess up it is and how it goes down, it's always going to impact how you react to it.
Yeah. Not that archery antelope is not a big deal at all, but if you were up here and we were blacktail deer hunting, and it was like the second to the last day, the only day that we were going to have nice weather, and you airmailed it, I would have had a different response. That would have been really sad and tragic. That would have been one of those, you don't say anything because everyone just knows, and you just listen to the rain hit your hat, and it's just quiet.
Yep. Yep. That, oh man. And I've had, I missed, I missed a lot, but a couple of years back, I guess it was 4 years ago now, I was blacktail hunting in Western Oregon, and had one of those exact experiences. You know, it was like the last day of season, and I actually didn't miss. I was not paying attention, and this buck caught me as I was just like playing on my phone. I was actually looking at Onyx. I looked up and there's this buck just staring at me in the eyes, and I go, you know, I was just had my head in the phone, and I just screwed the pooch, man. And you know, ever since then, and I will say, you know, after that disappointment, you know, I don't walk around with my head in my Onyx near as often. It's just like, nope, you're alert, your head is up, and you're walking like attentively, because anything can happen at any time.
Yeah, it seems like some of the bigger names, they still miss on occasion, but they've gotten through that terrible streak. Like I shot my first deer. I haven't shot a deer with my bow in a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I missed 2 years ago, and I missed twice last year. So I'm still notching tags and stuff, meat in the freezer, but like I'm in this streak of missing, and it's just kind of, man. But you think about, like, when was the last time Cody missed?
Last year.
But it's just like one miss, right? So he's still hitting home runs, you know, whereas some of us were still fighting through that.
I think a large part of that too is you think about just the reps, right? Like Brian Barney of Eastman's, he has a great video from, I think it was last year, the year before, where he's hunting deer in Idaho and misses a shot that, like, Brian Barney drills deer at 60, you know, yards plus a lot of times, and he misses like kind of a chip shot off a cliff. And gosh, it's so, I don't want to say it is encouraging to watch guys who you look up to or know that like are dead eyes and just practice, you know, they miss. And like Cody's scenario, he forgot that he had his dial set at a different yardage than where that elk was last year, you know, and those things, like, they just happen. And I think you still have to have the confidence that you can go out there and make every freaking shot. You can't go out there thinking like, oh man, I hope this goes where I want to put it. Right. You got to have some swagger. I think it's just like when you're talking about competing in sports, right? If you go out there going like, ah, God dang, I really don't want to lose today, that's not the good mentality. If you go out there, like I'm going to do my job and everything, like I'm going to do everything in my power properly. And then things mess up, then, you know, I think that's a totally different reaction, at least in my mind.
Yeah. And it applies to so many different things too. You've been getting some traction in the freelance writing world. You had a couple of articles in, was it Eastman's and Peterson's? Was it both or just one or what?
Eastman's, Peterson's, and Rockslide are kind of the three that I've been picked up in so far.
So after a while of either having to do free work or getting rejected, you get a couple in a row and you think, all right, now I know the recipe. And so when you do get rejected or someone doesn't get back to you, it's just kind of, oh man, okay, no, let's check back into the game. But it can be really frustrating right on the first bit when you're trying to make something happen. It doesn't happen.
Totally. It's like that whole notion of like, well, shit, maybe I am not even worthy to be submitting these. Like, what do I know? I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah. But once you get picked up, you start getting some validation. And I think that's how a lot of ways hunting goes. Like once you start getting some traction, you start getting some confidence and some validation. You're like, no, I know how to do this. You know, if you grind it out, and that's the thing when it came down to this antelope hunt, is like, I wasn't actually too bothered by that miss because I was like, well, I had this opportunity. I had two more days that weekend to hunt. I'm like, what's to say he's not going to come back in tomorrow or like the next day, you know, like if you just got to sit and be diligent, you know, just know that there's a tomorrow. If there's not a tomorrow, then, you know, maybe you can cry in your soup a little bit. But,
so what did you do? Yeah. What did you do differently? On the redemption, was it the next day or like 2 days later, something like that?
So importantly, I changed spots, for a variety of reasons, but there weren't a whole lot of antelope hitting that first water hole in the in the first place. There's a bunch of cows hitting it, and it just like, it was a drink tank for cows. So there is like a windmill that pumps water out. And the one nice thing is that windmill and the kind of structure that's right there. This is on Bureau of Land Management land too. So this is public ground. You can just set your tent anywhere. So that movement and that windmill that sits there, it makes it so they're less like, they're less weary of your blind. They're like, like it's just another object that's sitting next to the weird man-made thing. And so that's why I chose that spot, but it's the only one in the unit that I could find. And I knew that that was a factor. And then I'll be honest. I was listening to this other podcast. It was Remy Warren talking about sitting blinds. And he's like, you know, antelope, you can just pop them up wherever and they just come right in. And I was like, I have heard two different sets of information on this one. And so after that day, I only saw the one buck that I missed. And I was like, I know that there's another water hole. It's 2 miles away that is better. Like, and more antelope are hitting it. And so I set up on it that Saturday, and I had a bunch of doe groups coming in before the feral horses came in. And then the feral horses just camped out, and nothing else came in the rest of that day. I know, and I commented it to you. I don't know if I sent you a picture or what, but you're like, oh, they're so majestic. I'm like, these damn things are running off all the game. And there's 18 of them. There's a band of 18 wild horses. And gosh, I ran out and ran at them, kind of like, if you've seen Dances with Wolves, where he tries to run the wolf off. Anyway, I ran after them, and then they just like did the same thing. They like stopped and came back in as I walked away. I was like, gosh, dang it. So that one, I knew they were antelope hitting, but the horses screwed me up. And then I came back the next day, and sure enough, a bunch of antelope started hitting it. It was mostly does and fawns to start the morning. And then I started getting like bigger herds that were, you know, 7 to 12 antelope, and they came in, and all of them looked at it, blew their noses in this kind of sneeze sound that they make as an alarm, and then ran the other direction. 3 or 4 herds did that. And so I was like, Remy Warren sucks. He was wrong. And just so about then I was reading my book, and I looked up, and sure enough, 2 bucks were just trotting on into the water. And pretty much by the time I got my bow in my hand, and because it was sitting on my little stand, by the time I got the bow in my hand and was like ready to draw, he was drinking water. Right. And so anyway, he stood up he stood broadside at 32 yards and let him have it. And man, I will say, after that miss, this shot went right where I wanted it to, passed through. I couldn't have poked a pink mic. I wouldn't have walked up and put that arrow in a different spot. And I honestly think that was like the highlight. It was, you know, the miss coming back from that miss to like a shot right where you want it. Man, it just couldn't have happened any better. So, I stepped out of the blind, looked behind the blind, and he was tipped over back there 100 yards from the blind. So
perfect.
Yeah. Perfect. It was pretty uneventful. I mean, honestly, it was pretty uneventful. And, you know what though? Like, I mean, good hunting stories come, a lot of good hunting stories have like some twists and turns and like some hardships and stuff. But, man, that day of sitting in the blind, it was like 1:30 in the afternoon. So I hadn't even sat all day, and, he just tipped right over. And that's kind of how I want them sometimes, man. I like it when a good plan comes together. So
yeah,
it's pretty good.
You can't try to make something that's not all that, whatever, sound whatever, right? It's like, yeah
it's not all that epic, you know. I mean, most people would have lost their mind sitting in that blind, you know. This is boring.
What do you do? I've never really been on a hunt where I'm sitting and waiting for an extended period of time. It's always like maybe, you know, the evening hours waiting for something to pop out. We were stuck up on a mountain, Abby and I, a couple of weeks ago on a deer hunt. And it was super foggy, and she happened to have a movie that she had downloaded on Netflix for the flight up and hadn't watched it. So we watched Netflix, which is just so funny that, you know, you're watching Netflix in a tent while you're trying to wait for the fog to lift. But what do you normally do to get through those long, long hours of sitting either in a blind or glassing?
So glassing, I did this a little bit last year, I guess. So while I was glassing, and I was by myself, I put in a headphone in one ear, and would listen to a book or listen to a podcast I had saved. I really like that. It like keeps your mind going, and it actually keeps me in the game because I'm like, my eyes are stuck in the binos doing the bino thing while my brain is hearing stuff. And then same with, I listened to one podcast, 1 hour long podcast while I was in the blind, but I didn't really like that because I could hear antelope coming in before I could see them a lot of time. So then I just went to my book. I read The Mark of the Grizzly, which was an excellent book. Have you read that yet?
I have not. No,
it's a late 90s book. Scott McMillian. And there's a bunch of Alaskan stories, Montana and Wyoming stories in there about people getting attacked by grizzly bears. So anyway, read that whole book on one sit. And then the next sit, I read this book that my grandpa gave me, about Andrew Jackson and the battle for New Orleans. I didn't realize how interesting that was going to be. I got way sucked in. And that's what I was reading when that antelope came in. So I've got about a third of that one left to read.
Yeah, if I don't have something to direct my mind, sometimes it wanders to weird spots. Like when I'm walking through the forest sometimes or hiking up a mountain, I get like weird song lyrics in my head. Like, how did I even, what? Avril Lavigne, why is that playing in my head? This is stupid.
So it's nice song lyrics and weird sounding words. They'll just play on repeat in your head as you're just walking or hanging out by yourself. And you're like,
weird quotes from movies and stuff. Yeah, I don't know if that's normal.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's totally.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that you and I are the ones to really differentiate between what's normal and not, but for dudes like us, that's going to happen. I bet some people could just get dialed in and there's nothing else that they're thinking about. Like they're 100% present in that moment. They don't have any of those sparkly, shiny things going off in their head.
When there's action though, you know, and you've got a good example, you know, if I'm planning a stalk or I'm on a stalk or I'm watching something, you know, watching an antelope come in from way out, like I did with that buck on Friday that I missed, as I'm watching him come way out, I'm just glued. It, you know, it's just all focus is on that one thing. It just depends, you know, on the scenario too. So if I'm waiting out something, like last year I watched this buck bed and I wanted to watch him get into his afternoon bed, and I was glued to my binos waiting for him to move again for 3 hours, you know, from like 9 to noon. So I don't know. Just depends. You know.
Competitive nature can kick in too. And so this is the job that I have to do. It's almost like you wrestled, I played basketball. It's like you're locking back into that competitive mode. And there are times when nothing else really exists. I've done that a couple of times, glassing and looking down into this clear cut. And there has to be something in there. Just a matter of just find it. He's there. Just find it. He's fair. Just find him. He's there. Just find him. And then when you do, like, dude, yes. And then, all right, now it's time to make a shot. But yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest differentiators of whether or not like you're going to stay in the game and find it. You know, this morning we were glassing this spot that is the day before season opens right now. So we're glassing the spot that we might hunt soon. And we're like, these deer have been up and around this corner, like on this far ridge. And I'm like, we know they've been there. And you know, we're looking through, it's really smoky here, and we're looking through the smoke going like, God dang, it's really hard to see them, but we know they're here. And sure enough, probably 30-45 minutes after we've been looking, like they just popped out all of a sudden, you know, and they're like, ah, there they are, you know, we found them. But at first glance, you know, I mean, we combed across that hillside a bunch. I mean, that it's only one hillside we were looking at, but they were there. We knew they were there. That makes all the difference, man. It makes all the difference.
It's funny when you think that you're dialed in, but you're really not. It usually happens to me in the spring when I'm looking for black bear on the flat. So I'm looking at something that's very large and black. That's going to totally be obvious when next to green grass, and like, you won't even see it emerge from the woods. It's just all of a sudden 30 yards from the woods. You're like, dude, how did I miss that? Like, how did he sneak around there? We're talking about black contrasting against green. What was I doing? I thought I was dialed in, but no.
Now, to be fair, bears have an uncanny ability to all of a sudden just like, boom, be right in the open. I'm like, what? How did, what? How did that happen? No, it's totally true. I don't know what it is about bears, man. Maybe they just sprint into the open and we just never see it. But I've never watched a bear walk out of a tree line or anything.
No, maybe it's just the movement so slow and delicate because it's not like a color. It's, I don't know. I have an easier time picking up deer and even like mule deer when Abby and I were glassing down there, like they blend in a lot better, but there's just something about that movement that I don't know. It was easier to pick up.
And I wonder if it's the movement coupled with kind of the straight lines that come with ungulates, you know, like a straight line back and legs that are twigs and stuff. Cause when you look at a bear, it's just, especially from afar, it's just this little circle, just this little oval walking across the hillside. And, you know, I would think there's something to that. When I was glassing up in Colorado last year, I was looking into aspens. And you could look into aspens from a mile or 2 miles out and you could see the little lines of a back that cut the aspen in half basically, and you're like, ah, that's a deer back, you know. Yeah. even when they're in the middle of trees, it was kind of cool to see how you can pick them up that way.
Yeah, the faces I think are definitely something you could pick out too. Looks like a flux capacitor or something like that that's back in there, and you think, oh, there's our eyes, there's the nose, and then you see the antlers.
But, oh, I bet you have that all the time in like that thick stuff in later season hunting, huh?
Oh my gosh. And a couple of years ago, I was about ready to end the hunt. It was during rut. It was cold and dark, and it was getting to like midday. Well, it wasn't dark, like, you know, late morning type thing. And so you get out of the tent and you just wait for the sunlight, and then nothing's really going to happen. So we're about ready to call it quits. So I went behind this tree to take a dump, and then I just look up and I, you know, it's just branches again. Like, yeah, there's another, because branches look like antlers, but antlers don't look like branches.
So true.
And so I'm like, oh well, look at that nice buck. And then it moved. I was like, oh my gosh, it is. And so like I just pulled pants, went around the tree, grabbed my rifle, and then kind of snuck to it and shot it from like 20 yards. But
that's awesome.
it was crazy. Yeah. In addition to black bears being unbelievably stealthy, the elk getaway is something they can get through that forest with those massive antlers. And when Abby and I were looking at, we were trying to approach one of her game cams like we would if we were hunting, just to kind of get used to, okay, what would we do in this situation if we were headed to this spot? And if it was during the season, let's pretend, let's get like something underneath our belt. And as we approached, we did everything right. And then we spooked an elk and it went crashing away, but you only heard crashing for like two or three steps. And then it was like, it vanished. Like, I would think that you would hear that thing crashing for a half a mile, just hitting branches, limbs. It's a massive animal, but no, two steps, boom, gone. That's it.
One of the interesting things, and I think if you watch a bunch of YouTube videos and stuff, one of the interesting things about killing an elk in the woods is like, you'll shoot them and they'll run, and you can hear their footsteps on the ground, but you know, like when you hear actual crashing, that's when they've piled up. Because otherwise they don't make any like stick crash noises, and like a bunch of, you know, they don't make a big ruckus unless they're actually going down. I didn't realize that. And I wish I maybe would have known that the first year I shot an elk, because I heard my elk crash, but I thought he was just running off. And that next morning I went right to the last crash and he was laying there. I was like, oh shit, I should have just walked over here last night. I would have found him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's always the thing too. Like, how long do you wait for some of these? Like, is it good? Is it not? And then also, you know, one of the things that we're talking about archery hunting and making good shots, like in the alpine up here, you know, the thing is going to run at least a little bit. And there's some areas where it's going to go downhill and it's going to be absolutely lost. And so you gotta consider so much. And same thing with shooting mountain goats up here.
Yeah.
My buddy was out there with another buddy, and they had just come back from a doll sheep hunt, and his buddy got one, and he wanted a larger mountain goat, because he's already shot a mountain goat. So the buddy who just shot the doll sheep was like, dude, I'll take that mountain goat. It's fine for me. And so he shot it with a 300 Win Mag, and it just absorbed it. It only had like 5-inch horns, absorbed it. Took another one, absorbed it. Third one, absorbed it. And 4 shots that mountain goat took. And it was a young one. And so, but it was like, I don't know if it was just so young and vibrant that it was able to absorb those, but 4 shots in the vitals, and it just soaked them up. That's crazy. Absolute crazy. I can't imagine doing an archery hunt for mountain goats, because you don't have any shock. You just have
the arrow flying through, right? I wonder too, though, and someone maybe who has taken more mountain goats than the two of us, which is any amount, correct us. I wonder if there's if you double long a mountain goat, if there's a possibility that they can go bed down instead of fall off cliffs, you know? I don't know. The hunt that I was on
that was successful, I was just packing meat for a buddy, and he shot at 300 Win Mag, just dropped it. And the thing just like staggered back to its feet. It was just this just valiant, rising, defiant, I'm not gone yet. And so he took another shot, airmailed it. And then the second shot put it back down, and then it just kind of slid a little bit. But those things are just tough, man. So tough. Yeah.
When you think about shot placement, where are you putting each round on especially your high country bucks?
I'm going for the kill. You get that shock that can jack up the heart and the double lungs and whatnot. Some people go, you know, try to break one of the shoulders that can't run, but like you don't get a whole lot of meat off the blacktail. So like if you shoot through the shoulder, that whole shoulder is going to be done. Some people
so you'd go, rather go just slightly back from the shoulder, but kind of on the lower third.
Yeah. You have to take the rib meat up here. So you're going to lose some of that by taking that, but just drop it. The one I got with Abby, awesome buck, super slick mountain, but it happened to drop right where there was a big rock. And so it just fell. And then the rock was like right in its gut area. And so it was a perfect spot, but it was funny because I was super calm. Like we were out there and we saw them and they were bedded and it was foggy. And then tried to make the move on it, and then fog came in, so closed the distance, and I was just calm the whole time. I was like, this is an awesome experience. These bucks, they don't really care. This is awesome. So it was kind of walking toward us, and I was just ready for it to turn broadside, and it turned broadside, and yet I didn't like move my rifle scope at all to like get it in the side. So I ended up shooting it kind of like right above the collarbone, like at the base of the neck, dropped it. Just a great shot, but it was funny. I was like, man, that's exactly where I was holding, waiting for it to turn. But then when it turned, I didn't adjust. Like I just shot it. But I mean, great shot. That's not the type of the shot that I usually go for, you know, because if you aim more just behind, then, you know, you have a little bit more margin for error. But it was 100 yards and I felt dialed in. I was totally confident, totally looked good. So.
Man, I tried to take a long shot last year on an antelope doe that was facing me. And I was like, man, I'm tucking them right in there at 300 yards. I can, you know, shoot this doe facing me at 300 yards. And sure enough, man, I just yanked that trigger too much. And I got one of the back legs, and then everything, you know, goes to shit once that happens. You got to put them down quick, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't very quick though. And man, that sucks, because you know that was preventable. So I totally am. I'm on that board train of like, broadside stuff is like, unless it's staring at you 100 yards away or less, you know, I'm going to probably be waiting for broadsides.
Yeah. We talked about having that experience that gives you a lot of confidence in that caribou hunt. When I shot one right in the heart from about 300, it just made me feel, I mean, and it was, you know, negative. It had warmed up to -6 at that point. I mean, it was just, and I'd crawled down on this snow to get to the spot. And then I just felt so good and steady about my shot. And so just so much confidence, and it was only 100 yards too, but just that calm feeling. So this is the biggest blacktail I've ever shot, but I was just patient. Like, this thing is dead. As soon as it turns, it is dead. I feel great. I'm on it. There's no, just finish this thing off, and it was great. So, you know, I feel good about making that shot. But then with what comes with that is you start to get too cocky, and maybe I try to make that shot from a different distance, but 100 yards, man, like, that's, yeah, it was over.
I think I don't know for sure. I would like to project this notion that I think we're going to always have a roller coaster of confidence and lack thereof. You know, you go from like, oh, I can make this shot. Okay. I can make this shot. And, oh, I can make this shot. And then you go like, ah, shoot, I pushed it too far. And then you like reel it totally back. And you're like, okay, 200 yards and in, 100 yards and in, you know, like whatever that thing is, then you work back up. I do think, and then as I think time goes on, your peaks and valleys maybe get a little bit shallower, but it still happens. I totally think it still happens.
Yeah. I think if it doesn't happen, then you get to the point where, I know some of the people who make content, it almost looks so routine to them. Like, there's no enjoyment. I think it happens a lot more with like fishing, where, you know, people are already talking about what they're using as bait and talking to the camera before the fish is even in. You're just like, are you having any fun? Like, I would be having fun. Why are you not having fun anymore? I think it is different with hunting, but some people, you know, it's just so easy or so routine. But I think part of that is the people who are very, very successful, they do so much work getting to the point. So it's not just about the end result. They have done all of the work to get super close, and then it's over because they've done the work, rather than just send it from 500, you know, and then you get, you know, your whatever that ends up being.
I had a couple opportunities at one opportunity at 50, was it 58, another one at 63 on antelope while I was spotting stalking. And I told myself before season, I was like, 50 is like, 40 is really where I want to be. 50 would be like all the stars aligned and everything's perfect. There's not an ounce of wind, right? Like, and I'm standing up on my 2 feet, right? And I know that in years past, that first year I archery hunted antelope a bunch, I took shots 65 and further. I think the furthest one was like 68 or something. And I'm way better shot now than when I was wasting those broadheads, right? Like, as soon as those broadheads hit a big rock, then they're just screwed. Anyway, and it just was interesting because, like you said, like, if you're just not putting in the work to get close, or in this case with this antelope this year, like, not sitting there out waiting for these you know, antelope to get to 30 yards. I'm like, dude, 30 yards is like, we're talking, you know, we're talking 2-inch circle. Like, this is going down for sure. You know, like you said, once you put in the work to get to where, you know, this is where I'm routine. I think that's where you're, like you said, your practice and your like experience like takes over.
Yeah.
Otherwise you might be surprised when you 10 ring it. You know, 12 ring it. Sorry, 12 ring it.
12 ring, dude. You started this thing. I ran with it, but you got to be getting your 12 ring in correct.
There's a difference. So 10 rings are good. Don't get me wrong. 10 rings can win you some tourneys, but 12 ring, that's the money spot right there.
That just sounds like a great lifestyle type thing. I'm just 12 ringing it. How are things going? I'm 12 ringing. Yeah, sweet, man. It's like crushing it or killing it. But it's so much more specific, and I'm so happy to be able to poach a term that I don't even know anything about and use.
This is how we can gauge how much podcast has. We need everyone who listens to start saying 12 ringing in their lives. Exactly. And we'll see if we can make it a thing.
Yeah. I mean, it could be a whole bunch of different things. If a kid said it in one of my classes, I'd be like, hey, knock that off. I don't know what that means, but not good if a 17-year-old saying it.
Oh, that's funny.
So here's my dilemma. Speaking of 12 ringing, I have this feeling that when I go on my first doll sheep hunt, I'm not going to be successful. I'm totally fine with that. My main goal is to be in the physical, mental shape to be able to get where I need to be. And, you know, waiting out a couple days or, you know, Tyler Friel, right?
Oh yeah.
He just got back from a hunt and they went 3 days without food because they couldn't get picked up. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, like, I'm not, that's crazy.
But at that point they would have killed something, right?
I don't know. I'm not going to tell you the story because that's his story. So I'm only going to say that. So like, that's what I'm kind of up against. So I want to put myself in a position that I can handle the hunt and not go in with any sort of expectations. Because that's a hard thing to do. It's a difficult thing, especially a walk-in spot somewhere, you know, you're walking in, like you're doing all this scouting, but I mean, there's no guarantee that there's going to be anything that even lives in that area, let alone, is there going to be a chance to get one? Is it going to be full curl? Like there's so many things that have to go right. So just being, again, going back to that experience thing, I want to experience a dull sheep hunt. If my expectation is I want to go on a dull sheep hunt with you with, and it's going to end in a dull sheep, then I could be, you know, disappointed. So I'm confident I could make a shot, but I'm also fully expecting to have to go there twice, maybe even more, to actually make that happen. Because so many things have to fall in line to get a dull sheep.
Oh, totally, man. I feel like that's the mindset that of someone who enjoys the process or like knows the process they're getting themselves into and are like, you know what, if I do these things, and this is half of the battle, is like, do these things. If I stick with it, I do the hard work, and I go through my checklist. I'm not going to say it's always going to pan out, but if you run that checklist over and over again, you know, the chances are good, because as long as you have a good checklist, obviously you get it from someone who's had some success. Man, my stepdad, he just took a test for, he wants to practice. He wants to be a practicing psychologist with his own practice. And he had some final tests that he was trying to take. He took it 3 times. And this morning I just got the notice that he just passed it on his 4th try. And this thing costs a couple $100 to take every time. And there's a couple months between each time he takes it. And I'm like, that kind of like persistence and that kind of hard work, that studying and stuff, like whether it's your psychiatrist test or it's in hunting, like that is the kind of stuff that like, that gets you to where you want to be, you know, taking that test 4 times or going on that sheep hunt 4 times before you get what you want. Like that's the meat and potatoes. And that's what makes it fun, man.
Yeah.
That's in my opinion.
It's super easy after you kill an animal to say, it's not even about the animal, because you're excited because you actually got the animal. So
right.
I would love to actually get it, but I think too, that's putting myself in a position to actually enjoy that hunt and you know, be ready for it, and not just, I'm going to throw a bunch of money at it to try to make up for any sort of inadequacy that I have. I just want to run that program and see what happens. And chances are it's going to be so enrapturing, I'll be stoked to do it again, or I'll be so miserable, I'll think, yeah, all right, well, I gotta do that again.
Yeah. Yeah. Dude. So hold on. You mentioned this Tyler Field not having food thing. For the record, if I didn't have food and I was stranded in the Wyoming backcountry, I would eat like a king. We have so many high country raspberries, like a huckleberry varietal. I was just eating some rose hips today. And last week we picked a whole bunch of boletes, like a mushroom. I would be happy. I mean, I don't know if happy is the right word for it. I would be able to maintain my body weight, I think, if I was able to just be stranded for 3 days. Do you think that you could do the same up there?
Southeast, I could. The alpine blueberries are,
yeah,
at least 50% better tasting than the other berries. Man, they're just so juicy and so good, which is why the alpine blackberries is coveted. But
yeah,
you get to certain areas, and then there's leaves and there's, you know, grass, stuff like that. But you get to some of those up north spots, it's rocks.
It's rock.
Maybe some. Yeah. Yeah. So unless you're a caribou and you're just, you know, using your front teeth to nibble off lichen, there's nothing at all there for, you know, 2,000, 3,000 vertical feet of shale. So
that's a little bit tougher. Yeah. Are there rodents? Would you eat a rodent? Are there rodents up there?
Yeah, there's probably some. I don't know, you know, because that thing, they already start getting some so snow. Cool. I'm not sure if anything can live up there. I think maybe moths, things like that. I know bears get into some moths, but I there could be, you know, there could be kind of a death zone up there for some of those animals, just because it's so cold and so locked in snow for so long. But I'm sure something lives up there. But
lives. The only reason why I say that is because I had some marmot one time when I was in Mongolia, and it was actually pretty damn good. Yeah. We just like burned off the hair from the outside and then stuffed it full of hot rocks and cooked it from the inside out. And I'd do it again. That's all I'm saying. I don't know if I'm going to do it again willingly, like without some sort of preemptive like reason to do it. But anyway, I was thinking.
I don't know why they wouldn't taste good.
Yeah.
I mean, they're chunky little suckers, but, you know, they
got a lot of fat for sure.
Mink or marten being scavengers, you just don't think that they would taste very good based on what they eat, you know? But,
that's probably why people say bears taste bad too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think if you catch, I bet they do taste good.
Yeah. Anyway, if someone's eating some high far north marmots, they should let us know.
Yeah. Were you really hungry at that point?
Which point?
At the marmot point? The marmot?
No, it was like a delicacy. It was like a thing. We had like a bunch of elders over and they made marmot. I don't know.
Okay. So it wasn't like you, like the mountain house phenomenon where someone really enjoys it on the mountain so much they say that they could come home and they could boil up some water and have one for dinner.
No, that was, we were very much so in town.
So, nice.
Yeah. No, it's one of those things. I will say, you know, when you're off fishing or something, Jess and I did this year. It was like, or last year, we were off fishing and we had mountain houses and stuff to eat. And we ended up just cooking some fish over the fire and saved the mountain houses for another time. It was really good. I'm into that kind of stuff, man. I think it's a, I don't know if it's a lost skill or maybe just a not practice skill for a lot of folks, but just eating off the land is pretty fun.
Yeah. Bring a little bit of seasoning and just make it happen. Yeah. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you said there were some other hunts that you got going on this fall. What are your big ticket items?
So, I've got all of Wyoming stuff, right? So I'm spoiled by that. There's no ways around it. I've got an open deer or elk season in Wyoming from now or from tomorrow, September 1st until November 30th. I can hunt a buck or bull from now until November 30th. It's pretty sweet. On top of that though, my brother, dad, and I are going on an elk hunt in Oregon in the first or second week of November. And man, I've never hunted with all my brother and my dad and I all together.
Nice.
I mean, we've waterfowl hunted when we were kids, but like since we've been adults and since we've had big, you know, the big game itch, we haven't all three hunted together. And I'm just so excited for that. My grandpa actually, he was like, "Hey, can I come be your camp cook?" And I was like, "Oh, heck yeah, grandpa, like, come on up. Like, I would love to have all three generations up there." I told dad, I was like, "Hey dad, grandpa's going to be camp cook." And he's like, "Oh God, he can't even make cereal." Oh. I was like, grandpa just wanted to come. That's totally fine. It's going to be, you know,
well, that'd be the perfect environment for him to shine because, if you are on a hunt, then things tend to taste better. Hopefully.
Oh, totally. Totally. And then the other hunt is I've got a filmed hunt. That's kind of, it's for a brand I'm working with. That's kind of under wraps. But I've got a filmed hunt in Nevada coming up and, that's in the late October. It'll be super fun. It's a place that has a bunch of big bucks and, I know a lot of people struggle to find those big bucks. I know they live there, but I think it's going to be a pretty hard hunt, but with potential for something crazy, crazy big. So I'm pretty excited. That one is, I'm pretty excited for that one just because it's a crazy opportunity to hunt in a place like that. I didn't have to burn my Nevada points to get there because these guys fronted a landowner tag. So like I said, it's just, that's a wild experience in and of itself. I've never done a filmed hunt like that. At least one that, you know, was like kind of with a brand. So we'll see how that goes. I think it's going to be slightly, the dynamics are slightly different, right? It's not just like you're going out with by yourself or with you and your buddy, because there is that whole film thing and there's a little bit of pressure about getting something down on camera. There's no if ands or buts about that, but you know, we're going to try to make the most of it. And I'm going to try to make the most of the opportunity just because it's like, it is a hunt that I've wanted to do before. So it's, there's going to be more to come on that. Hopefully some good things to come.
Is there anything about your post kill routine that you're going to have to add or censor or anything? Are you worried? Like, do you like make squeaky noises? You're like, gosh, I got to make sure I don't do that on camera. Like, are you nervous at all about if it works out, how it's going to be portrayed on film?
I shot this antelope with my buddy Riley a couple of years ago, and he held the decoy and I was the shooter, and this antelope came in and I shot it, and him and I saw it tip over in sight. And we got so excited. We were like, oh my God, that was the sweetest thing ever. And I like ran to like go to the antelope, and I just smack hit my face on some sagebrush, right? Like this ran. I just imagine that's what's going to happen. I will say I've probably tempered my, my celebration since then, just almost like, you know, there's an element of like elation, but also I kind of have just tried to put a cap on it because some of that stuff gets a little annoying in my opinion. So no, I don't think I'm going to change anything. I think it'll still be fun. It's yeah, I when something goes down, I would say like it's super, like I said, there's a lot of elation, but then a little bit of like quiet elation is probably the best way to put it. You know, I don't want to hoop and holler and make a big scene. So yeah, it's kind of like, I don't know if you heard this in sports, it's like that act like you've been there before mentality. Yeah. I like that to an extent, you know.
Yeah, it's impossible to want to be 100% authentic, because like if you write about it, like you're writing about it, so like people are assuming there's some level of embellishment or you're remembering it a little bit differently or something. And then on TV it's the same thing. So is this like the real reaction? Is it a hyped up reaction for the camera or what? But some people try to, it seems like they do a really good job of like really enjoying it. They're super happy and you can sense that it's not like a production show, you know, the old handshake. Or no, the handshake thing sometimes seems, it depends on who's doing it, right? It's like, oh, I'm so excited, handshake versus
it depends, man. Like you said, a lot of that stuff, it just looks like kind of staged or fake or whatever. So
no, I hope you, man, go Ricky Bobby. I hope you go Ricky Bobby and the hands are up and you're just, I don't know what to do with my hands, and you have just like you're staring off at the camera and you're like stutter. That'd be hilarious.
That would be funny. Maybe we'll do an outtake of that.
yeah make sure you get just the real one first and then do like a separate sort of, so you don't ruin the actual thing. But that's awesome. that's gonna be a great experience.
Yeah, man. And you know what, like it's funny, like this kind of hunt that's filmed, it's one of those that I'm not saying it should be a slam dunk. I don't think any hunt's really a slam dunk. I know a lot of people who have gone into it with thinking it's a slam dunk though, and are disappointed. So even though it's the one hunt that's like kind of bought for, I think it's probably going to be the one that I hunt the hardest on. Just cause I know, you know, like my hunt with my dad and brother, it's going to be a little bit more like about being with those two and seeing, you know, if we see a bunch of elk and we get some, like, that'll be great. They like, but this other one is like, we're going to hunt our cojones off and pound a bunch of miles and spend a lot of hours behind glass and do the things right. It's kind of like when you're, I love these sports analogies, man, because it's like things that we go back to, like, man, we wasted a lot of time in high school or junior high and high school doing these sports things that didn't relate to real life. And gosh, I think so much of it actually, it really relates. But you know, like doing all the things right, running every play really crisp and like not getting sloppy. It's that same thing when you're in the woods trying to have a lot of success. Whereas, you know, with this family hunt, it's a lot more about relaxing. And I wouldn't be too surprised if the whiskey bottle comes out and when the snow flies and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. It's, yeah, the sports metaphors work. They're so relevant. And I know we've kind of gotten away from, like, sports being a metaphor for life was a thing that your coach had told you, and it was huge and impactful for so many kids. But now in culture now, it's, it's a lot less about competitive sports. You don't have to win everything. It's like, well, you're kind of missing out. It seems like people who don't play sports or choose not to play sports because it's a toxic environment or whatever. And they're not all like that. You know, if you have a good coach, you have a good teammate, you have a good experience, like you do learn a lot of that stuff and it does end up working out. And you do look back and think, you know what? I did everything that I made it look like I was putting forth maximum effort, right? But I could have given more. And that's the point. I don't want to look back and say I could have given more, just like I did. If I'd have worked hard, if I would have practiced hard, if I would have played better defense or whatever, then the basketball team could have been more successful. And then that ends up being, if I shortchange something that I love to do, if I say I love basketball and then I cheat the sprints, I cheat the drills, I do whatever, I don't work in the offseason, then I'm undercutting something that I love. I'm cheating the experience. And if I do that for something that I love to do, then what am I going to do when things are really difficult? So those lessons are absolutely learned with sports. Yes, there are toxic people and toxic coaches and teammates. And there's a lot of maybe, athletes are being used and they were getting, taken advantage of, this and that. Yeah. That absolutely happens. But you have a lot of people who, really benefit from those things.
There's also toxic people, coaches, teammates, and athletes in real life that, and our real life things that we do. And I think it just like, if you try to insulate from those things, they're not good. That person who hasn't experienced it before, when they get to a situation that really matters at work or at life, in other ways, they're not going to have the tools to address it. Totally agree with you.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there was like a moment you remember from high school, but I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. There's no need to go down there. Right. You have a map behind you.
Yes.
Do you scout on that map at all? Or do you just
Yes. have it up? So this map behind me, and I'll so that we can give people an idea of what Jeff is looking at. I've got a whiteboard behind me that I use for work, so that I do my to-dos and I kind of jot down designs and do stuff on this whiteboard.
That's right next to the whiteboard. Has nothing on it right now. I just want to let the audience know that your to-do list apparently is nothing. You know, that there's a glare.
It's a little bit of a glare. It says boots on the ground, which is actually Wyoming Wildlife Federation's like theme for our fall fund drive this year. Boots on the ground. We talk about the boots on the ground work we do. And that's where this is my inspiration board for that. Right next to it is a map. This is the level of importance I'm giving this map. It's right next to the thing that I look at every single day and where I go for inspiration. Because this map is a map of that Nevada unit that I was just telling you about. So every single day I'm looking at this unit and I know every drainage, I know where every spring is at, and I know where I want to go already. And this hunt's 2 months out. That's the kind of preparation, right? That's like getting home to some kid's bedroom and seeing a bunch of like the playbook for football or baseball or basketball or something on the wall. That's how I think of it. That's why that maps up.
I was thinking the same thing. And one of the reasons why I asked you about that is because I want to put up I want to do two things. One is a nautical chart from some of the areas here in Southeast, because we've been camping on a couple of beaches that at a 16-foot tide, like you can camp, you're all good to go. But if it's an 18-foot tide, then the tent's going to flood. So I haven't flooded the tent yet with these these campouts, but I want to make the notes there because you could put that on your phone. But there's just something about being able to stand up, look at the map, and just get that. And I also want to get a large map of a couple of the areas I'm looking at going for dull sheep, just so I can get that in my brain and look at that.
I totally agree with you. And I'm kind of pointing Jeff toward this other wall in my office. The opposing wall in my office is of the local hunting areas, because it's for the same exact reasons. I think that, like, obviously Onyx is great, base maps great, whatever, Go Hunt Maps, whatever you're using, they're awesome tools and they help you really get to the fine detail. But in order to understand and have that full picture, man, and something to sink in for me, it's got to be life size. When it matters most, I mean, it's like I said, it's $36 for this little map that's on the wall, and it's a weatherproof one. What is it? Rugged Maps, ruggedmaps.com. And it's one of those things where, like, dude, it just, I think it makes all the difference when you think about a big picture.
Yeah. What else do you have to kind of get you psyched? Could be even during the off season or as things are getting close. Do you have other reminders or other do you dry erase on your mirror or anything like that? Or
I one thing that I like to do in as far as preparation goes is I probably would be what you call like a visualization kind of guy. So in preparation for antelope hunting, I took my stool that I was going to sit on in the blind, and I practiced sitting on that stool and shooting at the target like over and over again from different distances to see where I was at. It's one of those things where you just like, I like to practice in conditions that I feel like might be similar to what I'm going to experience. I think going out and shooting off benches like at the rifle range is fun, but I really like going out to this draw outside of town and shooting off my butt or shooting kneeling or shooting off my pack, you know, and like those like different scenarios that you're actually going to see in the field. Those are the things it's like I said, it's probably more of the visualization stuff. At times I've run these little drills where you're like, okay, I have 20 seconds. You set your phone to go off as an alarm in 20 seconds. Like I have 20 seconds to make a shot. And so then you press start as you're standing, and then you get down on the gun and figure out the situation you want to make the shot and make the shot. Nice. Those are things I think that's that visualization type stuff that I think gets me pumped. It just gets me so stoked.
Yeah. I had a couple spots scouted out, one specifically for that mule deer hunt last year. And I just knew based on where we had glassed in June and July that this is where it was going to be. This is where it was going to be bedded and had the distance all down. I just imagined that sneak into this spot and it's going to be there. And so I had a plan and it was not there. And then it was, the yeah. 3 days of not finding anything and then missing a shot, but it is going into a hunt important to have like some level of confidence. You have some sort of plan. You're not going in totally blind. You're not totally obsessed, but you're prepared. You're ready, right? And goes back to sports metaphors, right? You have a plan going in. It's going to be totally different. After something happens, you have to adjust and read and react to different situations or weather or whatever. But, being dialed in, like there's something to be said for being engaged on some level that will help you pivot or hinge if you need to.
Oh, totally. Everyone's got a plan to you get punched in the mouth, right?
Yeah. It's my I think, like, too, right? Like,
no kidding.
How much would it cost or how much would it take for you to fight Mike Tyson?
Me?
Yeah.
Probably not too awful much. And the reason why I say that is because, one, it'd be a sweet resume builder to say you fought Mike Tyson. Like, duh. Logan Paul boxing. What's his nuts? Come on, help me out, man.
I don't know. I didn't watch it. I just saw that something happened, but I don't watch him or support him or talk
Mayweather.
About him.
Okay, Logan Paul boxing Mayweather, right? Like Logan Paul had no chance he was going to win, but he also is now known as the guy who boxed Mayweather. I feel like the same situation about Mike Tyson, right? The other thing is, I don't know if you've been knocked out before. I've been knocked out, and I'm not going to say it's pleasant, but like you recover. So
we're about to take a punch
long for that to happen. You know,
stand there and you just got to take a punch right to the head. So like, there's no, you're just taking a punch.
Do I get a mouth guard?
Yes, you can have a mouth.
Okay, guard. I'll take it.
But you're blindfolded. You don't know when it's coming.
Oh God. Yeah. I'll take that.
You'll just take it. Like, you wouldn't even I have to be able to get an elk tag in, some high.
I mean, if there was like an option
for life,
if there was an option to like trade for these things, I would definitely like try to negotiate this stuff. Yeah. Hmm. I mean, really $1,000 is probably the minimum, but that's pretty cheap. Actually, that's pretty damn cheap. Maybe 10,000.
10,000. Oh yeah. Yeah. That'd be good. But yeah, I think, if no one knows about it either, like you can't tell anybody. It was like, Mike Tyson, you didn't meet Mike Tyson and you sure as heck didn't let him punch you. If no one would know, like you had to keep it a total secret that you get this elk tag, you get this.
No, 10 grand, 10 grand for sure.
10 grand.
10 grand.
Would you do it for 1 grand?
If I got to like, if it got some sort of elevated promotional deal that could then eventually like help me in the future, I don't really have an interest of being like a Logan Paul though. So I don't know how that would really work out. Yeah, I don't know. This conversation has devolved.
Yeah. Yeah. I talk about that with my students once in a while. We just talk about, all right, this or this, like you're standing there and you just get trucked by, you know, Ray Lewis, like you have to stand there.
Oh, I'd love that. I wouldn't pay any money for that.
You would love that?
I had Ray Lewis as my, he was my, on my locker in high school. So he's a little bit of an idol. I'd be honored.
Honored to get destroyed. It's a lose-lose situation for him because he's like, yeah, I'm Ray Lewis. So I'm just going to just destroy this guy, bend this guy in half.
Yeah. It's yeah.
Oh man.
I take him out of the knees.
Yeah, all right. Jaden said laughing. Yeah.
Oh yeah. All right, man. Well, hey, I probably ought to get something done today.
Yeah. Well, you know, it looks like you got everything done since your board has nothing on it except for boots on the ground. So maybe go get some boots on the ground somewhere or cook some of that antelope for dinner. What have you been doing with the antelope?
Oh man, we did backstrap, just super simple, two nights in a row. I mean, salt, pepper, and a little bit of seasoning. The first night we did like this venison rub that's kind of sweeter barbecue style. And then last night we did the it was a jalapeno Mexican style seasoning on top of it. It was really good. Yeah, nice. That's it. And then we did some heart the first night. So yeah, it's right. Probably, yeah. We're going to do burgers wrapped in caul fat tonight, I think. So
oh.
I saved the caul fat for the first time. We'll see how that goes.
That's good. That's good. Well, hey, to close this thing down, give a little pitch for the Wyoming Wildlife Foundation. I know that a lot of people get involved with organizations that are not in their state, but benefit from that. So I don't live in Wyoming, but I benefit from the work that you're doing. About that cool migration shirt, you know, people, even if they don't live in an elk state or supporting your Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, things like that. So give a short little pitch for the Wyoming Wildlife Foundation, how you can support.
Dude, I really appreciate that. Yeah, the Wyoming Wildlife Federation has been around since 1937, working for sportsmen and wildlife in Wyoming. So it's got a lot of history of working on policy and legislation, which is sweet, sweet work that they've been a part of. You know, whether it's like getting hunter's education as an elective in school or allowing roadkill to be picked up and taken home as food. Those are all kind of things that we've worked on that level. And that's what Jess Johnson does for us as our lobbyist. The other thing that we've really expanded is our boots on the ground work, which is why it's on my board. We've done a bunch of habitat projects this last couple of years, and it's ramping up each year now. We just did a shrub planting on winter range for mule deer. And this is in the famous Red Desert to Hoback migration, which is known for giant deer. And it's just it's an awesome place to do a bunch of work like that. And on top of that, we've done some educational camps in town so that we can educate kids on the, you know, both navigation in the woods and kind of pack it in, pack it out style information for kids, but then also just more ecological information and about, you know, the natural world around them. So those programs have been really awesome that are newer, that are on the ground. And then lastly, we've really expanded our Hunters for the Hungry program. So that's kind of what I've been working on a bunch. Hunters for the Hungry is where, you know, if people are traveling out of state, let's say you've got a 50-pound limit and you're flying back to Alaska. If you want to donate the rest of that meat, you can go through a processor and give it to people who need it. So that's a great program that we're doing too. And those are all ways that we're doing stuff boots on the ground. And as part of our fall fund drive, which by the time this comes out, I doubt the fall fund drive will be kicked off, but look for it. We're going to have some Spoon and Crockpot limited edition t-shirts for picking up just during the fall fund drive. So I appreciate you letting me plug it a little bit. That's really nice of you. And I'm excited for it. It's a sweet design.
Awesome. Well, when is that, you say?
October 1st is when it's that whole thing's going to launch.
Oh yeah. This will be up before that. I'm not that ahead.
Sweet. Well, thank you for, yeah, again, thanks for letting me do that. And if anyone has any questions, or, you know, also just has any questions about hunting Wyoming, feel free to get a hold of me, man. I love, as you know, as much as anyone, I love talking about this stuff. It's why I do the work I do.
Awesome. Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. Take care, and we'll be in touch.
All right. Sounds good. Take it easy.